Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears.
Welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about all the wrong ways to motivate your employees. I'm your host, Laura.
And I am your other host, Elizabeth.
So, Elizabeth, what's been going on with you these last couple of weeks?
Well, Laura, it's funny you should ask because I have been dealing with, I would call it a crisis, and I hesitate to call it that because it sounds melodramatic, but technically speaking, it kind of is. So we've been having a lot of rain in Baltimore, and I live in a row house with a rooftop deck, and I live on the third floor. I live in the whole house, but my bedroom is on the third floor. Sorry, it's not one of those situations. Shut up. Anyway, I was minding my own business on Friday, taking a power nap, as I am wont to do, and all of a sudden, I feel a drop of water on my arm. So the first thing I think is the air conditioner, it's raining outside, so I thought maybe my window air AC unit is spitting out water from, it sucks in from outside, in which case I was like, well, that sucks. And then the water hit again, like, this water is coming from, like, above me. So I look up. And in my ceiling, there's, like, this yellowish, like, line with, like, droplets of water oozing out of it. And so, my landlady lives in Switzerland. like, for realsies. And she doesn't really have a sense of urgency about her. And so, I just had to email her and say, hey, landlady, we have a leak in my bedroom. And she's like, well, I'll get the worst handyman in the world who you have told me is terrible on multiple occasions to come out and look at it. And so I had to go literally like tarp down everything in my bedroom. And I put all my valuables in my bathroom so nothing would get ruined. And then I like fled to somebody's house for the night. Get back, stopped raining, and then, like, it's been 3 days and I haven't heard anything. So, I live in constant fear of the rain now.
Oh my gosh. So, are you sleeping in your bedroom now?
So, I am when it isn't raining. When it is raining, well, this has only been going on for, like, 2 days. So, I've only spent one night here since this thing happened. And it's not supposed to rain for the rest of the week, but we'll see. So, I'm basically living in a third world country over here. And I know it's Baltimore, and you can shut up about that. Because I know what you're going to say.
Hey, so did you get my text the other day when there was some gangbanger guy who had killed 40 people in Maryland, and he was like down here in Sandy Springs where I live.
Yeah, and, because yeah, maybe I sent him there because you were always shit talking Baltimore, and I decided that, you know, if you want to put your money where your mouth is,
you're just gonna prove me right.
I mean, I was, but it was gonna be in like the most dramatic way possible. I'd just be like, all right, here's what she looks like, here's her address, and then just, you know, send it there. When I asked
jokes
for your
on
address,
you then, because geography is not his strong suit, because he did not show up to my house.
Well,
thankfully.
Yeah, because they stopped him. But yeah, you got lucky there, so you better watch out. I heard that there are some big events coming your way too.
Yeah, so in like, I don't know, 5 weeks or so, I am taking the PMP, the Project Management Professional Certification Exam.
As opposed to the PIMP. I don't know what you heard about me,
but a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. So, yeah, I've got to get to, you know, buckling down there and studying a little bit harder.
What we're planning to do is take about a month off. We're going to record this episode and then hopefully next week's episode. And then that'll give you 10 episodes to share with your family and friends until we come back at the end of July or beginning of August. And during that time, I really hope to get the website and stuff up and running. So you can have that to look forward to. You can see pictures of us hanging out with our pets and maybe some outtakes, and we haven't decided yet, but it's going to be hopefully not terrible.
Right on
So,
par for this podcast, hopefully.
yeah. And I'd also like to give like a special shout out to Danielle, who is a fan that found us. I'm not quite sure how, but she was nice enough to send us a message on Facebook. And I think she might be like one of the first fans who isn't one of our friends
Right.
or like from one of our friends. So thanks, Danielle.
Thank you, Danielle.
Okay, so now that we've got all that out of the way, would you like to discuss season one, episode 9, We're Off to Kill the Wizard?
I would love to. The first scene, there's a guy in a limo in a big
Wait,
city.
wait, you're forgetting something.
Oh,
Or
no.
rather, no, or rather, they are forgetting somebody, something. Did you notice there was no tonight on?
No, really?
Yes. I had to go back and check. They neglected to put the tonight on, and spoiler, it's actually going to be in the next episode for some random reason. They didn't have the tonight on this episode.
Well, I maybe like the it tested better than they thought.
Yeah, it was very strange. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. That was very
Yeah,
rude of
I
you.
feel like you were waiting until I started to bring
Okay,
that
maybe I was. Maybe I wanted to steal the show, but go ahead. It's all
All
you.
right. As I was saying.
Hey, Laura.
Yeah,
Okay, I have nothing to say. That was
just
just.
guy in a limo, big city. He's talking to a guy named Horatio. He promises he'll bring Jessica back one way or another. Scene cuts to Jessica fixing a bicycle at a house. We're not in Cabot Cove. The scenery is very flat. And then there's like a little boy and little girl. Billy, he's like 10-ish. The girl, I don't know that she has a name. She's like 6 or 7, probably. And there's like some kind of conversation between Jessica and then this older lady, not older lady, like mom. It's probably the kid's mom. It is the kid's mom. So Jessica is flying to Kansas City for a lecture, and then she's flying directly back. And then about this time, the
I
limo pulls
should
up.
also mention we're actually in Chicago right now. So she's planning to fly to Kansas City from Chicago, but she had stopped in Chicago, I guess, to see her niece, who's the kid's mom.
Okay, I never realized we were in Chicago. I just thought that we were outside of Kansas City.
Yeah, at some point they say Chicago. This didn't come up until like a little bit later in the episode, but I think that's where they are. They're like in the suburbs of Chicago.
Okay.
And also, sorry, you can go ahead. I was going to say something about the guy in the limo
Go
who I just nicknamed him Corporate Goon
ahead.
because
Okay.
he's like this 6'3", 250-pound like giant man who you would probably see in like a gangster movie that would be around to like break people's kneecaps.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. I just named him Right Hand Man.
Later in the episode, I start calling him Horatio's Michael Cohen.
Kind of
That's
look
like a.
like Michael Cohen.
Well, and he does what Michael Cohen does, spoiler. Like, he's basically, this guy's corporate goon slash fixer.
I'll call him Michael Cohen.
Okay, all right,
So the
go.
limo pulls up to Jessica and then her niece, who I think is referred to Mrs. Donovan the entire show. She does not have a first name. This Michael Cohen guy wants to bring Jessica back with him to meet his employer named Horatio Baldwin. And when Michael Cohen mentions the name Horatio Baldwin, little Billy gasps and says, oh, horrible Horatio. Apparently, we learn that Horatio owns and operates theme parks. There's a new one right outside the town, Horatio's House of Horrors. And it's debuting today, and Jessica has been invited. And the kids are begging to go.
Two things of interest. First of all, I had to look it up on IMDb, but Mrs. Donovan's first name is actually Carol. So that is her name. I think it comes up later, but they do call her Mrs. Donovan at the outset. And this is the part where we meet the biggest star of the episode, not because he's a big star, but because he will be a big star. Mm-hmm. And who would that be?
So at this point in his career, he is going by the name Leaf Phoenix, but we will come to love and know him as River Phoenix. No, Joaquin Phoenix.
Correct.
River Phoenix died.
Did you know, you knew that the sister, I forgot her name.
Summer Phoenix. Oh, but in this show, she doesn't have a name.
Yes, but she's actually his real life sister, Summer. And I did a little bit of digging on the Phoenix family because I remember one of my rich British cousins was obsessed with River Phoenix, even though I think at that point he had been dead for a little while. This was back in the late 90s when she was obsessed with him. So
I saw a meme the other day that I did not agree with. And it said, if River Phoenix had not died, the world would have not needed Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay, that is categorically untrue. Because because River Phoenix, I could be wrong, but he struck me as more of a flower child and kind of a hippie and kind of a gentle soul, whereas Leo's just pure testosterone. And
really? You think Leo's pure testosterone?
These days? Are you kidding me? Maybe not at the beginning because that
not in his Titanic days.
Not in Titanic, not in Gilbert Grape and stuff, but like once he started getting really famous and working with like Scorsese, then he got super macho.
I mean, definitely like The Departed and Wolf of Wall Street for sure,
because then he started like morphing into Jack Nicholson and
I have been saying this for years, and then all of a sudden there was a meme about it, and then what I have been saying for years and years and years has been confirmed.
See, the internet was listening to you. You just didn't know it. So just one really interesting story about Leonardo DiCaprio and my ex-boyfriend is everyone made the joke about how Leo would keep getting nominated for Oscars, but he'd never get it. So the year The Revenant came out, my ex and I were watching a movie in a theater, and there's a preview for The Revenant, and we started laughing because it was another Leonardo DiCaprio, like, Oscar bait movie. And so we made a bet that day, a bet which I came to regret.
Oh, no.
Was that Leo, again, wouldn't get the Oscar, but Tom Hardy would get it for Best Supporting Actor. And we put $10 on it, and then it ended up our Leo won for Best Actor, and Tom Hardy didn't get his Best Supporting Actor. So I lost $10, and so, boy, did I hear about it.
I also have a story. So friend of the pod, Katie, her husband had this theory that Leonardo DiCaprio would die without ever having won an Oscar, but then there would be a movie about Leonardo DiCaprio, and the guy playing Leonardo DiCaprio would win the Oscar.
I can totally see that. Horrible Horatio is apparently a local celebrity because he has a series of theme parks all over, I guess, the Chicago area, and they're famous for kind of being a little PG-13 in terms of the type of offering that they offer. Is that my name? Oh, it's the fucking
ice cream truck.
Yeah. Guys, can you? We're going to have to wait until the ice cream truck goes by.
That is, I'm so jealous. I will move to Baltimore for the ice cream trucks.
My cat is afraid of the ice cream truck. Like, you can see the alarm in her face. Aww. She was a country cat. And, like, she literally looks like there's a predator in the room every time she hears the ice cream truck. Horrible Horatio has asked Jessica to meet, well, asked, meaning Michael Cohen has insisted that Jessica come to meet with Horrible Horatio at his newest theme park. The kids, you know, they blackmail her and extort her into going. And even knowing ahead of time what type of entertainment was on offer at these theme parks, they still go. And what we see is what appears to be a scene from the Renaissance Fair. I don't know if they have those down in Georgia.
They do, yeah.
So it's like we're at the Renaissance Fair, but it looks like they're staging an execution.
It's
And there's this.
very Monty Python-esque.
That is true. There's this guy. He's obviously the guy who's going to be executed, and he's in a cart and he's begging for clemency or whatever, and he's making a whole scene. And the kids are, losing their shit. And Joaquin Phoenix thinks this is the coolest thing he's ever fucking seen. So, if we're talking about Joker origin stories, maybe we should start here. He's walked up to the noose, and there's a whole thing. And suddenly we hear some shouting from offstage, and there's a guy in a fancy hat. And he's getting ready to rescue the doomed man, who we later find out is Horatio. He like kind of swings onto stage, but then the door in the stage where,
It's not a guillotine.
no,
No, that's where you cut it off the head.
Yeah, it's like whenever you're being hanged, you typically have the noose around your neck, and then they pull out a trap door under you so that you dangle and your neck breaks. The trap door falls out of the stage, and for some reason, there's a little bit of confusion. Like it seems like genuine confusion as to what's happened and if anybody's hurt, and somebody yells to call an ambulance. So at this moment, it looks like everything's gone off script and that somebody might actually be hurt. And then all of a sudden, you hear somebody shouting from offstage in another direction, and horrible Horatio is up at the top of the fake castle, like chuckling maniacally and welcoming everybody to this place of his. At this point, Michael Cohen tells Jess that horrible Horatio wants to talk to her, and she Jess is there with these kids, and she gives him a pretty strong tongue lashing about the violence and about the kind of scene, basically telling him this is really fucking terrible. Why would you show this to children? And he shrugs it off, and the bottom line is the bottom line. This stuff sells, and that's Horatio's shtick, and he wants to talk to Jess.
So the next scene is the office facility below the ground. This under the park, and Horatio mentions that it keeps the competitors out. Jessica and Horatio are just like walking the halls and talking, and then a guy, his name is Nils Highlander.
Coolest name ever, by the way.
He's a big guy and he's grumpy and he's got kind of like stringy, nasty hair and like a gross beard. So to me, he looks like the love child of Hagrid and Filch from Harry Potter.
I'm gonna
So
throw Rob Zombie in there too as cultural influence.
that's a really long name, Hagrid Filch Rob Zombie, but I'll try to stick to it.
Oh, I mean, you don't have to. We could just kind of keep that in the culture or in the cultural consciousness.
He does look a lot like Rob Zombie though. So Hagrid Filch just walking towards them in the hall, and he's clearly angry. He raises his voice and he says something about the city shutting down park for safety violation. Horatio just kind of brushes it off, and Hagrid Filch says, "Well, it's my name on the safety permits." And then Horatio gets really angry and yells, "Enough!" And it silences Hagrid Filch. And then Horatio tells Hagrid Filch to exercise discretion. And as Hagrid Filch walks off, Horatio just calls him a temperamental, bald-headed Swede, which I thought was kind of cute.
Are Swedes really known for being temperamental,
I
though?
would
Because,
think not.
I mean, I've heard of Swedish people being efficient and, maybe a little cheerless, but definitely not hot-headed. At this point, Jessica is still grossed out from earlier, and she's not really happy about being in this underground secret lair. where you can imagine she probably doesn't know how to get out, which would terrify me. It reminds me also of the underground tunnels that they have under buildings in Washington, D.C., to make sure that all the Congress and all their staff can not get murdered by rioters. So that reminded me of that. But
mean Antifa?
oh, you're right. It was fake Trump people. It was Antifa. It was Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry. He obviously has some kind of proposition for Jessica, and she knows right away that she doesn't want any part of whatever festival of gore is going on in his brain. And he tells her, and he uses probably one of the worst metaphors that I've ever heard anybody say on the show, and maybe anywhere,
I can't. Okay. And today, this would never be said.
no, and it shouldn't have been said then either, but still, he says,
"Please, Mrs. Fletcher, permit me the seduction before you cry rape."
total grab her by the pussy vibes.
Yeah, and he says it in such this, I mean, there's not really a good way you can say it, but he says it in such a smug, like, know-it-all kind of way that I just wanted to reach through the screen and just poke his eyeballs out with my fingernails. And after he says this, he ushers Jessica into his office, and this kind of dorky looking old guy peers out of a doorway, and then he kind of, shuffles back inside.
Yes, so inside the office, it's like one of those offices where you open the door from the hallway and then you're in the secretary's office, and then you walk through the secretary's office to get to Horatio's office.
I nicknamed it Mr. Baldwin's lair. It's underground. There's probably, I mean, they didn't have cell phones then, but there wouldn't have been any cell signal. There's no natural light, and it's just cinder block walls. And I mean, even if it's not cinder block walls, it has cinder block wall vibes.
Yeah, no, it's definitely cinder block walls. And it gave me the vibe from Mario Brothers, like at the end of each level when you're trying to save Princess, I think it's Princess Peach from Bowser's lair. It totally reminded me of that.
So we meet in this lair, Mr. Baldwin's secretary. Her name is it Lori Bascom? I think that's her name. Yeah. So Lori Bascom is a little mouse of a lady, and you can tell she's really sweet, and you can also tell, and this is to the actress's credit, that she catches raft after raft of shit from Horatio all day, every day. And she's timid as hell, but she's really excited to meet Jessica because she's one of her fans. And she tells her, "I'm a writer too. I've been trying to write a book, but I just can't seem to sit down and do it. I don't have the time or probably the emotional bandwidth after a day of being terrorized by your boss."
But just notices Jessica notices on the secretary's desk one of her own books. Did you catch the title of that book?
No, I did not. What
It
was it?
was called Dirge for a Dead Dachshund.
Oh, I remember that, but not from this one, but from somewhere else. Oh,
Oh,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, no, it comes up in another episode at some point. That's a cool title, but
It
as a
is. Is it like her version of Pet Sematary?
maybe she is ripping off Stephen King. We did talk about that, and well, I talked about that in the last episode with Christine, the evil station wagon. After we meet Lori Bascom, the scene cuts to Snoopy hallway dude whose name is it Henry Megrim? I think we learned that later. He bursts into an office where a general. Go
Do
ahead.
you mean Arnold? Arnold Megrim.
Okay, that's what I don't know why I said Henry. Maybe I just thought that's everybody's name.
He does have Henry vibes.
He does have Henry vibes. My grandfather was a Henry, and Henry is a very prominent name in our family. So maybe I just spend my time around too many
Is
Henrys.
it like King Henry?
No, it's not. It's just middle names all up and down both sides of the family. So, yeah, my brother is James Henry. My dad is Charles Henry. Grandfather was Henry Stevens. There's lots of Henrys in my
Are you
family.
Elizabeth Henry?
I'm not. I'm actually, fun fact about my middle name, I actually share a middle name with my paternal uncle. And the reason why I share it with him is because it is my grandmother's maiden name. And my grandmother didn't have any brothers. So her maiden name didn't have any people to carry it forward. So they kept sticking it with people. They stuck my uncle with it. And then when I was born, they gave me that middle name. And between my first, middle, and last names, I have like 17 names. My uncle Jim, who we've discussed before, the one you said that nobody liked, even though lots of people like Uncle Jim.
Well, Jen, I was wrong.
When I was born and my dad named me that, Uncle Jim says, "Charles, do you really want to inflict that name upon a little girl?"
Okay, well,
So
now you have to tell us what your middle name is.
it's McDowell,
I thought that
big
was
M.
your last.
No, that's not my last name.
What?
No,
I thought
it's my middle
that
name. You don't know me. You don't know my
was
actual last name?
your last.
Oh, well, that's weird. I'm gonna text it to you so you know it.
Wait, do you know my last name?
I do know your last name because I'm
Oh.
staring at it.
Oh, okay.
It rhymes with pants. Correct.
Yes.
Arnold Megrim, who I've nicknamed Snoopy Hallway Dude. He burst in on a gentleman in a black turtleneck who I've nicknamed Black Turtleneck.
Exactly, me too.
So Black Turtleneck is sitting at a desk. Well, he's sitting at one of those architect, designer, what are they called? Drawing boards?
Sure, the but it's like the if you say an architect's desk, this is what it is because it's like it's big and it's like at an angle.
Black Turtleneck is working at his desk, and Snoopy Hallway Dude is excited, or not excited, he's more like concerned, but urgently. He says, "She came. Jessica is here." Black Turtleneck isn't impressed, and he doesn't understand why Snoopy Hallway Dude is losing his shit. But Snoopy Hallway Dude, who doesn't, I guess, for the sake of exposition, he says, "More parks. More falsified accounts." Black Turtleneck still doesn't care. He's indifferent to him. He basically tells him to get out of his office because Black Turtleneck appears to believe that he is going to be named as vice president and that it doesn't matter that there's all this shifty stuff going on because he's going to end up benefiting from it. Hallway Dude doesn't believe it and tells Black Turtleneck as much, and then he leaves the office, and that's the end of the scene.
Yeah, so the hallway guy, I think he looks like a political science professor in college, but he says, yeah, he promised me that 2 years ago too, before he, snatched it away. So Horatio has obviously promised hallway guy this promotion to VP and is now promising it to Black Turtleneck.
We get a smash cut to Horatio's lair where Jess is saying forcefully, "The answer is no." Baldwin is pitching Jess on what appears to be a series of haunted house type amusement parks, and she's not having it. He's essentially saying there's no difference between you and I. We both cater to the lowest common denominator.
I've read your books. We're in the same business.
No, Mr. Baldwin. I write for people who read. You apparently stage your bloodbaths for tots who have not yet learned to differentiate between your sordid charades and the real world. There's quite a difference.
It was just peak Jessica Fletcher shade.
Yeah, it was again cut you so fast and so hard. You don't even know you've been cut.
She gets up from her seat and she tries to walk out of the door. All of a sudden, the door, like the deadbolt lock on the door, just slides closed by itself. And we see that Horatio is operating this deadbolt from this little trigger on his desk, and he has locked Jessica into his office and has imprisoned her.
And to which I have a note that says, okay, Matt Lauer.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Jeez. Oh boy.
Was so
Wow.
obvious. I expected more from you.
No, I was thinking of the tort of false imprisonment, and
Yes.
it's And it's, I guess, criminal counterpart, which she mentions, which is forcible detainment. I mean, I guess it goes without saying, but we're going to say it anyway, that you probably shouldn't go around locking people into places against their will, because that will most likely result in both criminal and civil liability on your part. So just don't do it, Matt Lauer. Eventually, he lets her out. Then, as soon as she leaves the office, he gets on the phone to someone named Mickey and starts talking in tough guy code on the phone. And that is the end of the scene. Apparently, he wants Mickey, this guy on the other end of the line, to dig up dirt on Jessica Fletcher, I guess, so he can blackmail her. And I'm really not sure what kind of dirt there is on Jessica Fletcher, but, like, good luck, I guess.
We're like back kind of like above ground at the park, and there's security guards walking around, and then they hear a gunshot. So the security guards run to Horatio's office, where they open the door to like the secretary's portion, but she's gone and the light's off. One of them says, well, that's odd. She never leaves before he does, referring to Horatio, but they know that Horatio's in the office in his office because his light is on. The other security guard calls a guy named Carlson.
Before they call Carlson, they try to get into Baldwin's office and they find out that it is locked from the inside. So they assume that he is in there because it is locked from the inside. They can't get the door open. So that's whenever they decide to call Mr. Carlson to figure out, or Black Turtleneck to find out what to do.
Carlson, Black Turtleneck, says, break down the door, use the fire axe if you have to. So that's exactly what they do, is they grab this fire axe and they break down the door. But what I found funny about this scene is they didn't just like break enough of the door to where they could stick their arm in and unlock the door and then open it. They literally use the axe to break down every piece of wood in that door. At one point, they could have broken down probably half of the door and stepped through it, but they kept breaking the door till every piece of the door was gone.
So this actually, okay, think of how often you get a chance to really truly destroy something, Laura. And if somebody gave you permission to destroy a door, do you think you'd stop with halfway?
No, but this reminded me of Tim Allen from the show Home Improvement, where he was just like the big testosterone, like, oh. So like, yes, you're right. This was their chance to use a fucking axe, and they're, goddamn it, they're going to use the fucking axe.
That's right. This is probably the most exciting thing that's ever happened to them at their job and probably their entire lives. Mm-hmm. They're going to be telling people about this for years. They find Horatio and he is slumped over his desk and he's holding, or appears to be holding, a gun. And it looks like, at first blush, that he has committed suicide. They kind of have just enough time to take in this tableau when all of a sudden Black Turtleneck peers through the busted up door and appears shocked. And he wants to know what's going on. He looks at this mess and all of a sudden, you know, I don't know if it's at that point he also gets on the suicide train, but that's kind of where this starts, essentially, is they decide, the security guards and Mr. Carlson, that suicide is probably what happened.
Yeah. And one thing that I noticed the first time I was watching is when he busts through the already busted down door, he's not wearing his black turtleneck anymore. So that he's got on just like a white button down and a tie.
We are back at the Donovan house. We are inside this time. Joaquin Phoenix is at the table talking about how great all the gross stuff that he saw that day was, and Jessica's making burgers. In an interesting exchange that they have between the two is he uses the term hung whenever he was referring to the manner of death for the doomed man, and Jessica lightly scolds him and basically tells him to stop being so gross, but then she has to make sure that he's technically correct.
Everybody thought the guy really got hung.
Hang, Billy. Drapes are hung. People are hanged.
While they're, you know, kind of all puttering around, we meet Carol's husband, who I've nicknamed Detective Bert.
Because, me too!
Oh man, we need to stop spending so much time together.
Or maybe we should spend more time together so I know your freaking last name.
Yeah, I know, right? Oh man. There's a phone call for Detective Bert on the phone, and we meet him. And Detective Bert is, how would you describe him, like, physically as a person?
He's like such a dad. So he's, I would say he's probably 5'10", and he's got like blonde curly hair with a receding hairline, glasses, and he's just like a dork. Like, he was a dork in high school, he was a dork in college, and now he's a dork with a badge.
But he seems like just such, but not one of those dorks who's resentful of being a dork. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna lean into it. I got a hot wife and kids and a pretty good job, so like, I'm not gonna be a dick about it.
Yeah, no, he's definitely, he's a good,
he reminds me a little bit of Napoleon Dynamite, just like a little bit. Maybe it's the hair. It's, and the also hair. I don't know, did you ever watch Sex in the City?
No, I did not.
Okay, there's a character in the early seasons named Skipper who reminds me of this guy.
Wait, was Skipper married or had a baby with one of the...
No, that was Steve. Oh. You're thinking. Okay. But he was dating Miranda in the early seasons. Steve's the one who had the baby with Miranda.
Okay, so I guess I have seen a few of the episodes. But also, fun fact about Detective Bert, he was in a show called The Paper Chase, which was based off of a book by the same title about a guy that goes to Harvard Law School.
I have never seen the TV show of that, but I have seen the movie and I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
And that was something that I think I actually made Katie watch our first few weeks of law school, which, you know, is the quintessential, like, first week of law school movie, that and Legally Blonde. Detective Bert gets this call. He finds out that Horatio Baldwin is dead. But his captain wants to talk to Jessica. I guess they want to talk to her because she is one of the last people that he had spoken to or spent any time with before he supposedly killed himself. The captain over the phone tells Jessica that they're operating under the assumption that it was a suicide. And Jessica says he was far too narcissistic to kill himself.
Basically, which
is correct. Yes. And nobody who spent any time around him, whether it was immediately before or, you know, just ever, definitely doesn't strike me as the type, unless he were about to be like arrested for something terrible or he had lost all his money or something. Like, that's the only situation I could see something like. Yeah. And he would probably do it in like, oh my God, do you know the Bud Dwyer story?
The what story?
The Bud Dwyer story.
No.
About probably this country's most awful public suicides. He was a Pennsylvania, like, state politician. He was street treasurer.
Yes.
He
took out a gun from the podium, right? And then...
No, he had it in, like, a manila envelope. And he was, like, pretending he was going to read a statement. And he, like, read a statement and then he shot himself on live TV.
Yes, I did. I've seen that video.
I have not seen the video. And that's, like, my home state. Like, he would pull a Bud Dwyer type situation if people were breathing down his neck. He wouldn't just be like, oh, I'm going to do it in my office randomly. Or unless Jessica, like, really hurt his feelings. The next scene or is kind of a continuation of the same scene is whenever they get to the park, because I guess the captain asked Jessica and Detective Bert to come down to the scene of the crime. There are lots of police cars outside the park, and we see Jessica and Detective Bert getting off the elevator, and they meet Captain Davis, who is a very fast talker, or a very, like, Chicago guy, I guess, is what they're going for. Mm. And he tells them that Lori Bascom is missing. She just disappeared. They haven't been able to find her. Nobody's seen her since Jessica left her office. They believe that Horatio was murdered because an examination revealed that it was a blow to the head that killed him and not a gunshot. and that the whole suicide tableau was staged. However, the door was still bolted and there was no way in or out, and that's still a part of it that's jamming everybody up, and nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah. And one line that I like from Jessica is that, you know, she says, well, I'm confused. Previously, you said you're saying it's not a suicide. But now what you've described with, you know, it with Horatio being locked from the inside, no trap doors, no windows, you know, they're underground completely. She says what you've described has to be a suicide.
So we're kind of left to chew on that. And Jessica is deputized by our Captain Davis to assist because I guess he appreciates her murder mystery skills. Doesn't he say his wife's a fan? I can't remember. There are just so many people are either like, I'm a fan, my wife's a fan, like my turtle is a fan, like somebody's always a fan.
But yes, he does ask for Jessica's thoughts and she just shrugs and says, I have no clue.
The next scene we see is a pretty short one, and we see Jess out jogging, which is good to know that even when she's on vacation, she still keeps up that healthy lifestyle. Uh-huh. And she's wearing our favorite gray tracksuit. Mm-hmm. She comes back to her niece's house, and she comes back to the local paper that has a headline about Horatio on it, and it announces that Lori Bascom is still missing. She gets kind of an aha moment, like a mini aha moment, and then she walks into the house, gets on the phone, and calls the airline, doesn't say the airline, and asks to change her flight to Kansas City. So there's something is afoot. We don't know quite what it is yet, but that's something to kind of hold on to for later.
Two things kind of strike me in this scene. And it's one is she just walks in and dials the airline number without having to look it up. Like she just knows the airline's number and dials it immediately. And then the second thing is that someone answers on the other end. So I think that if they were to shoot this scene today, they would have Jessica screaming, speak to a representative, like 17 times for the scene to be accurate.
Yeah. And in the meantime, she's like hitting zero on her cell phone after she's had to Google the customer service number. Yeah. And then the whole scene take, you know, 45 minutes. And then we get 30 minutes of just god-awful hold music. Yeah. We had to update it for today. That's what we would do. So maybe she's on one of those VIP lists, like some airlines or travel agencies and stuff have people, really big customers who spend a lot of money and who have flown a lot and done a lot of traveling, have special super secret lines they can call. Yeah. Supposedly. Yeah.
Sure, we'll go with that.
I wouldn't know. I still fly Southwest everywhere.
Yeah, but I bet you're rich cousins now. We are back at the theme park. I think we might be like underground. Maybe, I can't really tell, but we're at one of the rides. And this particular ride begins with like, it's Horatio's face, like a big, big face. And Horatio is talking, but something is malfunctioning with this ride.
I had it down as spooky animatronic Horatio is here to haunt your dreams. And I think this is part of where we're supposed to get a little bit of the Wizard of Oz imagery, where they have the big giant face and it's speaking and but it's not actually him. So I just thought that was probably the closest thing we get to Wizard of Oz imagery, considering the title of this episode.
Yes, and you're probably right, because, I mean, I really haven't seen Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, it's just that the end part where they meet the wizard, and it's this giant face, and it turns out to be just a machine, and it's all a sham, and that kind of.
Hagrid, Filch guy, and Turtleneck are working on it, but they're wearing, like, blue lab coats.
I know. I noticed that too. That was really weird.
Yeah, it was really odd.
Maybe they just need more pockets.
Yeah, maybe they do. Jessica comes in looking for Turtleneck. Turtleneck introduces Hagrid Filch to Jessica, and Jessica says, we met briefly yesterday. Did you get your problem straightened out? And then very sternly, Hagrid Filch says, I've got no problems. And then a phone rings and Hagrid Filch says that he's forwarded his calls here to that phone, which I thought was very odd. How long did he plan to be there to have his calls forwarded? Because I know, like, I've gone on vacation before and I haven't even bothered looking up how to forward my phone.
Well, maybe he was expecting a certain call and he wanted to make sure he didn't miss it. I think, you know, it's supposed to set something up for later. So
it definitely does. Yeah.
I think that's the only reason why it's in this particular spot, to show that call forwarding is a thing that can be done and has been done.
And it was actually at this point that I actually figured out who the killer was.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You're even ahead of Jay Fletch. Look at
you.
I know. I actually had a little bit of deja vu when I was watching this, because I was sure that I remembered the plot and I was pretty sure who the killer was as well. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't remember if I was remembering it from this or from something else, like Columbo or something. Uh-huh. Or if this was a plot that had been used on multiple shows. And I still don't know, but I was right about the killer, so. And at the same time, Black Turtleneck is insisting that Baldwin was murdered. He tells Jessica, when she asks him who would want him dead, he says, everyone. And when she points out that he benefits directly from Horatio's death, Black Turtleneck, to his credit, kind of owns it and says, tell me who to thank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very aggressive about insisting Horatio was murdered. And he continues throughout the episode to be very aggressive about this.
Do you know why he was a fan of the murder theory? Because it doesn't really change things, does it, in terms of how it affects him? So I would just wonder, at least in this point, why it would be so important for him to have been murdered versus killed himself, or why he would have been so vocal about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, foreshadowing spoiler, it seems like it would be in his best interest to aggressively promote the suicide theory.
The next scene we see is a big building, which is apparently an airport.
And it wasn't even really that big of a building.
No, it wasn't that big of a building. And she just pulls up to the door and is like at the gate. And then the guy, the flight attendant or airport guy, recognizes her and he kind of ushers her to where she's supposed to go. The whole scene was really weird. She didn't have any luggage or anything.
It was just supposed to be like a one. Well, no, because she was going to fly to Kansas City to give the lecture and then fly right back that same day.
All right. That makes more sense.
The flight employee guy that gets her out of the taxi says, oh yeah, your flight's leaving in 10 minutes. Can you imagine pulling up to the front of the airport and getting on your plane in less than 10 minutes?
No. And this is from a woman who made her flight to London with less than 30 seconds before cutoff time.
Wow.
Like, I've never run that fast before since pre-9/11 and pre-anybody caring about airport security. And as she's walking to her gate, which is apparently 5 feet away, she runs into corporate goon, a.k.a. Michael Cohen, who has been sitting there in the airport waiting for her. So he I don't, first of all, how does he know that she's there? You know, there's any number of ways that he would have known. And he's got a gun at the airport. And he pulls aside his coat and points at it and does that thing where he has the gun, but he doesn't have the gun. And she says she'll go with him because she's curious, not because gun.
Right. And then I'm thinking, like, don't say that out loud. That's not going to help you in a trial.
Just Michael Cohen, an airport guy, all squeeze onto the world's tiniest. It was one of those little kind of golf cart type things. that they ride
a golf
out
cart
onto
with
the,
wings.
yeah, no, like out into the tarmac. No,
Okay.
they're not in a golf cart with, what are you talking about?
I thought that's how you were describing the plane.
No, that's not how I was describing the plane. They were going out onto the tarmac in this
Okay.
tiny little like golf cart type thing, and they're all three of them like wedged into the seat. And those are those little carts that they attach the luggage
Yeah.
things to pull them out into the plane. It's not the plane, Kranz. What do you think? I don't know what a plane is. And all of a sudden, like she's being kidnapped for the second time in this episode onto a small private plane, and that's never a good sign when you're getting kidnapped onto a plane.
But what probably never happens is that she ends up safely at her intended destination. But during this flight, we meet Erica Baldwin, who was Horatio's wife. And I can't remember if it was Jessica that said it or Erica that said it, but basically she's had four husbands and now has been to four funerals. She is a one-time showgirl, now America's wealthiest widow.
Did you catch what Jess said about her outfit?
Erica Baldwin was wearing black. And didn't Jessica say something to the effect of, you're going to wear it out?
Reminded me of the time where, who, what episode was it where she goes to visit the widow who is playing golf and says, I didn't know they made that in black. What episode was
Oh,
that? I
so
cannot
that was Birds
remember.
of a Feather.
Oh, yeah, you're
When
right.
she pulls up right to the golf range.
That's what this reminded me of. It's just, and to her credit, Miss the now widowed Mrs. Baldwin is cool as a cucumber, and she admits essentially that she wasn't with her husband, that they just kind of lived separate lives, that she was boning Michael Cohen,
Okay,
and
I was wondering about that
yeah,
because,
that's what she said,
okay, so
essentially.
she says, basically with the help of Michael Cohen, she has not remained celibate, but Horatio Baldwin has. So I didn't know if that meant like they were doing it or like if Michael Cohen was like her look.
I think Michael Cohen was her guy. They seem really cozy.
Yeah.
She tells Jess that she offers her $100,000 to prove to whoever is relevant that Horatio was murdered and not that he died of suicide. And the reason ends up being that Horatio, his property is all mortgaged and he's in debt, but there's this huge insurance policy that pays off like what, $4 million or something that
It
she
was,
gets.
yeah, 2 million.
That's still a pretty good
Yeah.
chunk of
I mean, in
change.
today's money, that's probably like 19 million.
Most likely. Yeah, you're the economist here, so
Yeah.
I'm trusting you. Jessica and her have a little back and forth about Jess doesn't want her blood money, and Mrs. Baldwin tells her to give it to some pathetic little charity of hers or something.
I
And
think she says, give it to the orphans then.
yeah, so that's the end of that scene. And I guess they take her to Kansas City without incident. Being on a plane against your will is probably the worst place to be against your will.
Yeah.
And this is just the nerd in me, but don't you have to file like flight plans and you have to have passenger lists.
You really
Even
do?
back then, this stuff was heavily regulated in terms of who was going where and on what plane, so I guess the planes wouldn't crash into each other.
Yeah, I mean, that was something you would hope would be heavily regulated, but
It was the 80s. Who
yeah.
knows?
Something that I want to point out that is, you may probably not find interesting, but in most insurance policies today, although there may be that suicide clause where if the holder of the policy or the who the life insurance policy is on does commit suicide, they don't have to pay out. That's generally only valid for about 6 to 12 months after the policy is signed. So most of the time, these days at least, it's not forever.
So if I ever want to commit suicide and give somebody a lot of money, I just have to like wait a year. Okay, that's good to know. Okay.
But you know what? J just review the fine print, folks, before you sign it.
Absolutely. Yeah, don't All that boilerplate stuff, that's where they get you. Yeah. That's where you sign your life away.
We are back at her niece's house later that night. And then when Jess walks in the door, there's the secretary. And then she just kind of randomly admits to killing Horatio.
She says it in a really strange way.
Horatio Baldwin is dead and I killed him.
Yes. And it turns out the reason she's saying it that way is because she feels guilty because she left the office that night before Horatio did, which she never does. And then that in turn allowed the killer to get to him.
She said that he bolted his door after she ran out of the office, and that he had this nasty habit of digging up dirt on people and kind of keeping blackmail files handy just in case they needed, you know, someone to do something for them or what have you. So that's another thing that we learn. He was literally blackmailing everybody and all of his employees. Apparently they had files on everyone.
Yes. Again, with the files.
Files are important. I may or may not have like a filing cabinet in my home, like for personal papers.
Well, I hope it doesn't get rained on. So next scene, we are back at Horatio's office and we are looking for some kind of secret cubby. The captain and Black Turtleneck come in and Detective Burt explains that they're looking for blackmail files.
So at this point, the captain believes that Lori Bascom is guilty and he wants to have her arrested. Jessica still thinks there's a little bit more to the story, and you know, that's why she's snooping around in Horatio's desk. Black Turtleneck is also there. He's just kind of snooping around, asking questions, not really doing a whole lot, but getting in the way.
Yeah. And at one point, Turtleneck, you know, plays dumb and says, "Oh, what files are you talking about?" But Detective Burt puts him in his place and says, "You know what files." Everyone knows that that's how he kind of creates his loyalty from his employees, is that he has blackmail files on everyone. And then just randomly, Jessica sits down in Horatio's chair and asks about the temperature. And she's like, what do you think the temperature is right now? Turtleneck says it's an even 68 degrees controlled by a central unit. And then Jessica points out, well, if the air is controlled by a central unit, why is there a built-in thermostat on the desk? And then points out additionally that there is soot on it. So in a very James Bond type move, Jessica strikes a match that's on Horatio's desk and she puts it up to the thermostat. And then when the thermostat reaches 100 degrees, the top like corner of the desk moves, revealing like a secret hidey space, and the secret hidey space is empty.
I also had James Bond shit written in my notes because that's exactly what this is. This is a Bond villain like Ernst Blofeld level of secret compartments. Mm-hmm. Jessica thinks that Mickey or whoever he talked to on the phone is actually corporate goon / Michael Cohen, and she believes that he is the one who's been doing all the digging up files and he's the one that's been doing all the intimidating. So it's at that point that I had nicknamed him Michael Cohen because that's apparently what the real Michael Cohen was doing. And before anybody gets mad, he's like literally admitted to this, like in federal court.
He allegedly admitted to it.
Can you allegedly admit to something if you do it in federal court and it's on the record? We are back at the airport and Snoopy hallway guy is trying to get the hell out of Dodge. And he has a attaché case. He's trying to get on a plane to Mexico City, which is probably our first indication that something's wrong if he's fleeing the country. As he's checking in, apparently he's on some kind of watch list or somebody had called in a tip to the airport people. And all of a sudden, the cops are after him and he starts running through the airport, which is either the most normal thing that you can do at an airport or the most suspicious thing, depending on, I guess, why you're running.
Yeah.
At one point at the end of this chase, Snoopy hallway guy falls over and his briefcase falls open and it's just full of money. The scene ends with this poor guy, like, I think he's lying there, like, as this money spills out and he keeps yelling. It kind of made me a little bit sad.
Yeah, no, it was definitely sad. And then everyone's grabbing at his money that's like blowing away in the end. And he's just like, looks like a crazy guy yelling, "It's my money, it's my money."
Oh, poor guy. The next scene is Detective Burt, who's interrogating Megrim, who apparently was the company bookkeeper, but he was also an embezzler, and that he, Mr. Megrim, had gotten a call that the police had found Horatio's files, and this was enough to cause him to take $100,000 and try to flee the country. At some point, he says something that really speaks to me. He asks about his cat, who he had left behind with his landlady, and he really wanted to get back and make sure that she was okay. So, first of all, I'm like, maybe you should make long-term plans for your pets when you flee the country, but also, yes. I totally understand.
So, do you know what legal issue this kind of brought up for me?
What legal issue?
Civil forfeiture.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, so for those of you that may not know, civil forfeiture is a way for the government, the police, to seize any assets that they believe were involved or a result of criminal activity. So in this case, it seems like the police are thinking that Mr. Megrim may have embezzled this $100,000. If that's the case, the government can seize this money, and then they have different programs, governmental programs that they give it to. And the course of action for Megrim here is to file a lawsuit to get the money back. My issue with civil forfeiture or asset forfeiture cases is that the standard or the burden of proof is not beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's not up for the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that money was a result of criminal activity. It's not even preponderance of the evidence. It's essentially more likely than not.
I don't think we've talked about that too much, about the different standards or different burden of proof standards in civil versus criminal cases. But essentially, criminal is about the highest you can go, and that's the beyond a reasonable doubt that you see. And then the preponderance of the evidence is basically the 51% type situation that you run into in a civil case. This more likely than not is even lower than that. It's like all things being equal. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in a situation where things kind of end up looking like more or less even, don't you construe things in favor of the state in these situations? Or for some reason, all I know about civil asset forfeiture is what I saw in John Oliver. So I don't actually know too much about it. But that's the impression that I got, is like, it is super easy for the state to take your stuff, your money, your property before you're convicted, or even if you're not convicted of anything,
There have been several cases where someone is not convicted of a crime, but then they do have their money and their assets seized as a result of civil forfeiture, because the burden of proof is, 51%. So it's just more likely or not. So the state has to prove more likely than not that this person was engaged in criminal activity, and as a result, they received this money. So this is, to me, kind of a situation where the defendant doesn't have, the assumption of innocent until proven guilty. They essentially have to prove they were innocent, which is a little bit of a problem for me personally.
Basically flies in the face of the due process clause, like the life, liberty, or property situation. I'm sure there's some technicality or something whereby they get around that. But in addition to it feeling unfair, it is. Well, who's to say what even unjust means and what it means in this context. But no, it's pretty bad. And I don't know necessarily where the assets go once they are forfeited, quote unquote. But I know that, at least according to John Oliver, sometimes police departments and, you know, local governments and stuff, they will use funds to their own betterment. Like, mm-hmm. if they take $10,000 off of, you know, some poor, sad bookkeeper who's fleeing to Mexico City, you know, and all of a sudden everybody gets a bonus that year. Like, that kind of thing.
No, it's most of it is used for the department. So if it was just like your local police department, they would receive most of the money and then they can use it to fund whatever program they want, whether they want to use it to fund retirement or salaries, or if they want to buy new machine guns or tanks or whatever.
So guys, just be careful whenever you're doing anything that involves large amounts of cash or anything valuable, because the cops will take it from you. This has been Depressing Things That People Can Do to You Legally with Laura and Elizabeth.
Call your local senator.
Okay, this is where I'm a little bit confused, because at this point, have they gained access to the files? Because I know they're looking through them, and or is that later?
So the files, okay, so the person that committed this murder, so he put the blackmail files into Megram's briefcase. With the exception of, he replaced his own blackmail file with something that was a little less nefarious.
At some point, they said, like, his big smoking gun was that he was a draft dodger or something in Vietnam, which, first of all, I think, was it Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter pardoned all the draft dodgers, so it's not like he'd go to prison, and also nobody cares.
Right.
By that point, like, nobody wanted to think about Vietnam, so that was essentially nothing. Michael Cohen is in, I guess, it's his apartment, and he's wearing pajamas and a bathrobe, and it's clearly nighttime, and he hears cat noises.
Yep.
And what does a person do when they hear cat noises, Laura?
They go get the kitty!
Exactly! Did you know, and I'm sure you do, that cat meows have actually been, they were biologically evolved to mimic the cries of human babies.
Yes, so that way people will hear them.
Exactly.
And also, cats don't meow to other cats. They only meow to people.
I was about to say that too. Cats talk to each other like on, you know, this other wavelength. But they talk to us through the meows. If they're meowing, like, they're meowing at you, bitch. Like, they want their food and they want it now.
Yes.
Or they want you to put them down, or they want you to, like, stop dressing them up or taking pictures of them and sending them to your mom. Michael Cohen, he keeps hearing this cat noise, and he gets frustrated, so he goes out onto his balcony of his apartment, and he's trying to locate the source of this cat noise. Once he gets out there, and I don't know if he realizes, but we see that it is a tape recorder making the cat noises.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, somebody all in black comes up behind him and does a strangle and then tosses him off the balcony.
Yes. And I don't know. I rewound.
Jesus, I can't talk today.
So I rewound this a few times because the Michael Cohen falling off the balcony was so funny, because it was so obviously a dummy that they used, and it wasn't even a good dummy because the features were painted on and you could still see the dummy smiling. And they didn't even use hair. They didn't even use hair. They just painted on hair.
Oh, geez. I need to go back and watch that. I was not paying enough attention, but that's hilarious.
Yeah.
So obviously somebody wants Michael Cohen dead. It's most likely the same person who killed Horatio, but we'll see about that later. It's the middle of the night, and Detective Burt gets the call. Carol wants to know what's going on, and I think Burt explains to her that Gardner, Michael Cohen, was Baldwin's fixer slash blackmail person slash goon, and that they were trying to get some dirt on Jessica. And since she's back at the House of Horrors, he needs to call her and warn her. He's cheesed that she went back there basically without telling him or without asking him, but he needs to warn her. And luckily there's a private line into the office, which again, you know, we're kind of pushed towards the phone side of things. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to pay attention to that.
The next scene is Jessica in Horatio's office, and then a security guard shows up. And then the phone to the secretary's office rings, and the security guard answers it. It's Detective Burt. And then the security guard transfers the call from secretary's office to Horatio's office. They talk for a second, and Jessica sees something that makes her kind of investigate the phone after the call. So when Jessica is hanging up the phone, she sees that extension 1999. That light goes off, but Horatio's extension is 1998. And so she picks up the phone, takes the cover off the back, and one of the wires in the circuit has been cut. She starts asking the security guard a bunch of questions, like the security guard is a network engineer and knows what's going on, but in this case, he does.
Yeah, he knows a lot about phones.
He does know a lot.
Everybody knows a lot about phones in this place. Yes.
We are privy to the fact that if you use your own line, so if your line is 1998 and you call line 1998, then that call would come through on line 1999. So Jess uses the secretary's phone to call Horatio's line, again 1998, and tells the security guard to go answer it. And the security guard's walking into Horatio's office to answer the phone, but it isn't ringing, but it's still working. So at this point, Jessica knows who did it and how.
We have Black Turtleneck, who's back in his office at his architect's desk, and Ned, the security guard, who had just been explaining all that stuff to Jessica, came in. Ned comes in and says that he has a message from Jessica to call her at Carol's house. Black Turtleneck dials supposedly Carol's number, and Jessica gets on the line and she starts talking about how there are some files on microfilm that are hidden in that tunnel of horrors, and that she needs to meet him to discuss with him what's going on. And so she asks him to meet her, and I think it's about 30 minutes because she says it'll take her about that long to get across town, because at this point he thinks that he's talking to her at Carol's house, but, or maybe he's not, we don't know yet. That's the end of that scene, which kind of dovetails into the next scene where my notes say back to hell, I guess, because we're back to that, you know, animatronic, you know, nightmare fuel that is Horatio's face. Michael Jackson from the Billie Jean video decides to come down and start looking around for these files that are supposedly in the Tunnel of Horrors. All of a sudden, he is ambushed by Jessica, who explains to him in pretty thorough detail the magic of call forwarding, which is kind of a rehash about what Ned had talked to her about, where she said, oh, I wasn't really talking to you from Carol's house. It was just forwarded to me. I was in Horatio's office or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then he pulls a gun and shoots a mirror, which shatters. He shoots what looks like Jessica, but it's a mirror. It shatters. Then the police show up. And then it turns out that there was no microphone. And that's the end of the scene. It happened very quickly. And it was just, it just seemed kind of slapstick almost.
Yes. And during this whole kind of ambush conversation, we find out that Horatio had promised Turtleneck the VP position. And then for whatever reason, decided to take it away. And Turtleneck was real pissed off about that.
Do you want to kind of explain the next scene? Because the next scene is basically just Detective Burt explaining phones.
Yes. No, that's exactly what it is. So we are back at Horatio's office and Detective Burt is explaining how everything happened. And he's explaining it to the captain. And I think the security guards are there and a couple of other police officers. He's just kind of, you know, going through and explaining everything that Jessica has already discovered and already proven. He's explaining it and getting credit.
He asked her if she wanted to do it and honestly seemed like he actually meant it, not in the Amos Tupper kind of way, but right. In the actual, I acknowledge that you did most of the work and figured this out, so I am going to let you explain it. And she defers to him. What happens, what he explains the whole call forwarding phenomenon. And then he also mentions the old kind of switcheroo that Black Turtleneck played. Basically, what happened was Black Turtleneck was lurking in the corner of Horatio's office when the security guards broke down the door. And while they were distracted by Horatio's dead body on the desk, he snuck out behind them. And since he was wearing all black, he didn't really catch much attention in a dark room. What had happened was they had called him, but he had forwarded from his office to Horatio's office, answered the call in the office, then snuck out after they had broken down the door. So that's why they didn't see him. Again, that was the plot device that I had kind of gotten plot deja vu on, but couldn't remember if I had imagined it or remembered from this show or remembered from another show. Like, he was pretty lucky he decided to wear a black turtleneck that day.
One thing I wanted to talk to you about is the actual killing. Horatio and Turtleneck were in Horatio's office and they were arguing. At some point, it looks like Horatio may have charged at Turtleneck and Turtleneck pushed Horatio back and Horatio fell backwards, hit his head, and that's when he died. At this point, a crime may not have been committed.
I mean, you could argue, and if a crime hadn't been committed, or if it had been, it could have been like a much lesser crime.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been manslaughter, or he could have gotten off on self-defense. Mm-hmm. And this happens quite a bit in shows like this, is where people will get into arguments, somebody will fall, or there will be what amounts to an accident, and then the person will panic, and then in the cover-up, they just end up either committing another crime or making it worse somehow. So at this point, I think we figured out that Black Turtleneck killed Michael Cohen. If he hadn't killed Michael Cohen, do you think that he might have had a shot at not going to prison forever?
So the reason he killed Michael Cohen was because Michael Cohen knew exactly what was in those blackmail files. So gotcha. When it came out that what Horatio had on the blackmail files was that Turtleneck was a draft dodger, Michael Cohen would be like, oh, whoa, no, that's not all. Mm-hmm. So that's why he killed Michael Cohen. It was gotcha. To hide what was in his actual blackmail file.
Okay, so he probably would have ended up killing Michael Cohen anyway. I guess I'm a little bit confused about that, is whether one or both of these murders was not necessary.
I think that maybe during the altercation, Horatio died, had Turtleneck called the police right then, he may have had a shot at self-defense or, like you said, like manslaughter, something negligent at best.
That is kind of what happens, and Detective Burt tells the story, and he's a pretty good storyteller.
And so the last scene, we are back at the airport for like, what, the third time now. Mm-hmm. And Detective Burt and the secretary are seeing Jess off. Jessica encourages the secretary to start her book. And then the secretary's like, oh, well, now I'm going to have to find another job and I'm going to have to pay rent and da da da. And then Jessica gives her a check. This is the check that Erica Baldwin gave Jessica for, I guess, solving the mystery and proving that Horatio did not commit suicide.
This was supposedly the check that she got from, she said it's the check that she got from Mrs. Baldwin, which was supposed to be for $100,000 in 1984 money, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right. Yes.
Do you know how much that amounts to in today money?
Do you have it pulled up? Because I want to guess if you do.
I do have it pulled up.
Okay, so $100,000 in 1984, I'm gonna say $310,000 today.
No, but you're closer than you think.
Okay, what is it?
$259,000.
Oh, I was not that close.
This is why I'm not a math person. It's $259.90.47 today is what it says. Yeah.
Essentially, this secretary doesn't even need to write her book now. She's got half a mil.
She's got a quarter of a million.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm on my third white claw sometimes now.
Okay. Now you're giving me shit about not being good at math. I'm not the one with the MBA. Basically, the last scene is Jessica laughing once she sees Lori Baskett being like, what the fuck? Look at all this money. That's the way it ends, and I'm glad this airport departure scene is slightly less awkward / terrifying than the last one, because it doesn't end focusing on somebody's creepy soulless face.
All right, Elizabeth,
oh boy,
how do you like this episode, and who do you give the Golden Grady Award to?
I give the episode 8 out of 10 ashtrays, which okay. I think might be my highest to date, because I have been notoriously difficult to please. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I actually liked a lot of the characters. Horatio was an asshole, and I could see why somebody wanted to kill him. Like, it was actually a little bit of a head-scratcher. And it had its wacky moments, but there weren't too many of them. It had a cat, or it alluded to a cat. So that means that I like it. And if I had to pick a Golden Grady in this, it would be Detective Burt. And
me too.
Not in a mean way, mm-hmm. because he looks like I think he's a self-aware Golden Grady. Because he knew that, like, he wasn't able to solve this on his own, and he offered up the credit where it was due, and he wasn't trying to pull an Amos. Basically, he was just a humble guy, and he wanted to do the right thing, but I think Jessica also understood that he needed to look good for his boss.
Yeah, he needed that win for sure.
Because I don't think he was a bad detective, but no. I mean, all things being equal in that situation, I also think she did the right thing by giving him the credit. Because while it was a team effort, she obviously did most of the work. So what about you? Did you like it? And who is your Golden Grady?
I did like it. So I would probably give it 7 ashtrays out of 10, just because I figured it out so soon. So that would probably take an ashtray away. I mean, I am pretty good at solving like these like murder mystery detective shows, but Murder, She Wrote, not so much. But Golden Grady, 100% agree. Detective Burt, you're right. He's a good guy. He's a good detective, but he is getting all of the glory for solving this crime, even though it was given to him by Jessica.
So would you like to just very briefly discuss episode 10, which will be our last episode before we go on a brief hiatus?
I'm going to defer to you.
This one is actually at the ballet, and it's called Death Takes a Curtain Call.
Ooh.
It says, two Soviet ballet dancers on tour with the States are wanted following the murder of a man backstage during their debut performance. So this one's really interesting because if I remember it correctly, there are these two ballet dancers who were trying to defect. Mm-hmm. And that, like, the Cold War was still raging at this point. Like, the Soviet Union wouldn't break up for, like, another, like, 6 or 7 years. So there's a lot of Cold War espionage and lots of fun little nuggets like that. That's something that we can look forward to before Laura decides that she wants to go and be a grown-up and not spend her free time recording this podcast. Before we go, again, thanks everybody. Thank you, Danielle. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Rachel for our art. And thanks to everybody who like, share, and subscribe. And just remember, stay woke.
Stay woke.